Our first speaker is going to be Mark Shellhammer. He's from Johns Hopkins University. I wanted to meet Mark for a long time because I know his wife, but I didn't meet Mark until yesterday. He works on vestibular systems. He's a neuroscientist, and he's going to be our first speaker. He also plays in a jazz band. Will you join me in welcoming Mark Shellhammer?
Thank you. I have to start by saying this talk really has nothing to do with bioethics. I hope you're not disappointed in that. And in fact, has really almost nothing to do with ethics at all, unless you count the fact that I stole some of the images for my slides from websites without giving attribution. But other than that, it's not an ethics talk, only by example. I want to talk to you about a few ideas that I've been mulling over lately about continuing creation as it relates to neuroscience. The neuroscience part of the talk I'm fairly comfortable with and will be largely factual to the extent that I got the facts right. The implications and how this relates to religion and theology at the end is admittedly a little bit more opinion and conjecture. So you'll have to keep that in mind as we go along. So I want to start by giving a little context. I'm going to start with a quote from Jennifer Wiseman, one of my closest collaborators, an essay that she had published entitled What God Whispers Through Radio Telescopes in the book Perspectives on an Evolving Creation. And the key point is in the first sentence up there. It is still a surprise to most people to find out that the universe is not static. Indeed, as we study our dynamic universe, it becomes clear the creation is not a static collection of matter, but rather a universe evolving according to the processes and forces set in motion long ago. The key point here being that a straightforward reading of Genesis, of any creation story, would have people think that the universe was created. It may have taken a while, but now it's done. And now we can explore the universe, but it's pretty much a done deal. In fact, astronomical observations, such as this one, tell us that that's not the case. The universe is still being formed. So here's an example. Jennifer will correct me if I'm wrong. She's never been shy about that in the past. This is an example of an image from the Hubble Space Telescope of a galaxy called the Large Magellanic Cloud. And this is an area of current, active, intense star formation, even now. And what you can see in this image is a large cloud of gas and dust, that is the nebulous area here, illuminated by nearby stars. It's the accretion of this gas and dust that actually creates a star over millions of years. And we know that these stars are relatively new because the gas is still in the area. The gas is still near the stars. When a star is formed, my understanding is that radiation pressure will push the gas away. Therefore, if you've got gas near the stars must have been newly formed. And the fact that you've still got gas and dust around there means that more stars are going to be formed in this area. So this is an area where stars are still being created, where creation, on an astronomical sense, is still being played out. Now, why does this have to do with neuroscience? Well, I'm going to draw a little bit of an analogy from continuing creation in astronomy, continuing creation of the universe, to continuing creation in neuroscience, within ourselves. Now, I'm not talking about an evolutionary time course. This is not an evolution creation discussion. This is a discussion of what I might consider a form of continuing creation after we have been born. So, again, a straightforward reading or interpretation of Genesis might lead you to believe that the universe is created and done. May have taken a long time, but it's done. Likewise, I think a lot of people tend to think that once you're born, many of the neural processes inherent in the brain are a done deal. They are largely finished. Obviously, we learn things. The brain develops. Obviously, children, when they're first born, infants can't walk, so they develop new skills that involve the brain. But I think there's a tendency to think that the fundamental processes are fixed. they're done once you're born. In fact, I'm going to show you a fundamental example of where this is not true. There are many examples of this, by the way, but I'm going to emphasize one, and that is vision. So again, I think most of us would tend to think that vision is such a low-level, fundamental, important process that the wiring has got to be there in the brain. And if you're unfortunate enough to be blind for some reason or another, maybe it's just a blockage of the information getting from the eye into the eye, from the eye back into the brain somehow, but nothing very fancy going on, no kind of fundamental problem in the brain. In fact, that's not the case. So I'm going to give a couple quotes here from a very interesting book by Zecchi, which I've cited down at the bottom, but this is a quote that from von Senden that Zecchi has quoted, so this is a study back maybe several decades ago. And the point here being patients with long-term blindness, for example, they may have been born with a cataract, they recover sight later in life, they can't see in the sense that we think of vision. So here's a quote from this study. The process of learning to see is an enterprise fraught with innumerable difficulties. The common idea that a patient must necessarily be delighted with the gifts of light and color bequeathed to him by the operation is wholly remote from the facts. And in fact, there is a quote from a young woman, 14-year-old patient, whose sight was restored. And as you can see by this quote, she is not exactly overjoyed with the fact that now she has sight. How come that I now find myself less happy than before? Everything that I see causes me a disagreeable emotion. I was much more at ease in my blindness. Why is this? What's going on? Well, in this sense, literally, the brain does not know how to see. The brain does not know how to interpret the visual information. So what these people, in fact, see is color, shape, form. It's an incoherent mess. There's no meaning to it. They certainly cannot relate it to anything that they may have experienced by hearing or by touching. There's no way to relate that to something that they might now be able to see. And that's because, in a very real sense, visual function is not hardwired. The brain must learn to be able to see. It must learn to interpret this visual information. So now I'm going to take a little side course into the science and explain a little bit about the visual system to make this neuroscience finding a little more solid. And I have to say I'm going out on a limb doing this with Bill Newsom in the room. Bill is a neuroscientist of some stature who's done a lot of fundamental work in the visual system. He'll be talking tomorrow in the neuroscience track. I knew I could count on you. So, very simple version of the visual system. You got the eye out here in the front, carries information over the optic nerve to something called the lateral geniculate nucleus, which is about in the lower center of the brain, and then projects back to the visual cortex, which is actually at the back of the head. The first projection, the most strong fundamental projection, let's say, is to something called the striate cortex, which describes its anatomical features, an area called V1. Now, there are a number of cortical areas in the back of the brain that process vision. Let me tell you what they don't do. They do not create a little map of the image that's formed on the eye in the back of the brain. That's not how vision works. In fact, the image is parsed into pieces. There are neurons that respond to orientations of objects, respond to motion in various directions, respond to form, respond to color, and the image is parsed out into those properties, and later brain processing and later brain areas has to put that image back together into a coherent picture so that it's something that we could say that we actually see. So here's an example of some of these cortical neurons. Here's an example of one that is selective for the orientation of objects. So ignore the arrows here, but you can see here's a histogram, essentially, of spike rate, spikes per second. That is the intensity of the neural activity of this particular cortical neuron when presented with lines in various orientations. So this is vertical, and then this is going oblique, and then horizontal, and then oblique again. And you can see that the maximum activity of this particular neuron occurs when the organism, an animal in this case, was viewing a line with that orientation. So these are orientation selective neurons, one of the most fundamental types of visual processing. These were found by Hubel and Wiesel, classic visual neuroscientists. They got the Nobel Prize for this and related work several decades ago. These cells are, by the way, organized into what are called cortical columns. So here's a little, very, very small, perhaps a millimeter square piece of the visual cortex. This would be the surface of the brain, and this would be going down into the brain. And if you take an electrode and penetrate the brain vertically this way, what you would find is that there's a sequence of neurons going down, and they would be all selective for the same orientation. And those orientations would change as you move along. And also there will be columns that alternate their sensitivity to image information from the left, the right eyes. So there's very large dramatic segmentation of the image early on. Now, knowing that, we'll be in a better position to interpret the experiment that I'm going to tell you about, which unfortunately is an animal experiment. So Jennifer will have to apologize later. But this is not an experiment that I did. I am just the messenger. So I'm going to tell you about an experiment, a number of experiments, as a matter of fact. This one, particular one, goes back to 1975. Cats raised with exposure to only one type of visual contour. So they're raised with, for example, only vertical stripes in their environment or only horizontal stripes in their environment. And if this is the case, they become essentially blind to the opposite contour. So if they are raised just with vertical contours, they can't see horizontal contours in a very real sense, which I will show you on the next slide. Here's a quote from one of these studies. The cats reared in vertical stripes acquired following responses, that is, their eyes followed this object, to a moving vertical rod much sooner than to a rod that was horizontal, because they really couldn't see the horizontal rod. Taken to its extreme, you could imagine, I don't know if it's actually happened, that these cats would walk right off the edge of a table, for example, because they can't see, the brain cannot process the information on the horizontal edge of the table. Some cats would deliberately rotate their heads in order to place the image as close to vertical on the retina, so that if it was a horizontal line, they would try to turn their head so that the retina would see a vertical line with respect to the eye. So that's a dramatic behavioral example of what happens in if you expose these animals to an abnormal visual environment while they're being raised. Here's an example of some neural data from a similar but slightly different experiment. I'm just going to talk about two sections here that are outlined in orange. A normal animal, let's go over here. What you can do is put an electrode, a microelectrode, into the visual cortex of these animals and map out the response directions that cortical cells are sensitive to, just like I showed you before, the histogram that shows you the direction selectivity of certain cells. You can do that for a number of cells and see what orientations this part of the brain has specialized in processing. So let's go just look at these two over here. These are just polar diagrams that show the sensitivity of different neurons in different directions. And what you can see over here, this is the best example, is that there is approximately equal distribution of intensities. The intensity is determined by the length of the line in different directions. What happens if an animal is raised with only lines in this orientation, right oblique lines? Well, you see that the sensitivity of those neurons changes dramatically. There are very few neurons that are sensitive to lines in the direction orthogonal to the way that the animal has been raised. And there's very strong sensitivity to lines in that direction. So when we say the animal is blind to orientations that it has not experienced during development, it's really blind in a very fundamental way. The brain does not have the processing capacity to deal with these orientations. It's not a behavioral problem. It's not something you can train them out of, except possibly by exposure. Now, let me make a little aside here and tell you why this is an important finding. in from a medical standpoint, from a treatment standpoint. This is something called strabismus, which is another name for lazy eye. And here's an example of a child who has this. This is misalignment of the eyes with both eyes viewing. So you can see this child is trying to look at something straight ahead. One eye can look at the object and the other eye is completely misaligned. But what happens in a case like this is that there is extreme, as you can imagine, extreme double vision, because it's impossible to line up the images correctly on both eyes. And to deal with this, the brain reduces visual processing in the weak eye. In other words, in this case, the brain will essentially start shutting off the visual information from this eye. And vision in this eye will be dramatically affected, and that's something called amblyopia. And that's not a good thing, because that means even if you could correct later in life, correct the strabismus, the misalignment, you'd still have defective vision in one eye. This can be treated, and treated very well, by forcing the weak eye to align and look at things. So what you would do in this case is patch this eye for a period of time and force the child to use the other eye. Now, here's the problem. How long do you patch that eye? Right? Because this experiment, these animal experiments, tell us that the longer you patch that eye, the more you're inhibiting development of the good eye. So you're going to try to bring the bad eye into alignment and keep its vision intact. In the meantime, you're screwing up the bad eye, the good eye. So that's an example of where that kind of experiment really has a very serious practical implication. Chronic patching at an early age could adversely affect the visual development in the eye that's patched. So there is a lot of work on figuring out exactly the right scheduling for patching. Okay. Now I want to get into the part that's a little bit more conjecture. I want to talk about some implications of these ideas for how we might consider our role in creation or how creation came about. If creation is understood, it's not only structure but also function, as in the case of astronomy, then in some sense we are still being created. Creation is an ongoing process. God created the process and not the final product. This is not necessarily an implication, but it's occurred to me it may be one way to help resolve these two statements, which on the face of it are somewhat contradictory. If we are created in God's image and yet we are imperfect, how do you reconcile these? Well, perhaps we have within us the processes for perfection, or we are still being, in some sense, created. This raises a number of questions. I do not have the answers to these questions. What does this mean if we are God's highest creation? What does it mean to be created in His image? And perhaps are we partners in the creation in some sense? Now, Christian theology has long made a very serious distinction between the creator and the created. Nevertheless, when we pray or when we do what might call good works on earth, are we not doing some of God's work? Are we not partners in His action and in the world? And in the same sense, somewhat the same sense, are we partners in our own creation? These experiments that I showed you tell us in a very dramatic way that what we're exposed to has a dramatic impact on how the brain develops, literally what's going on inside your head. So that's an example in which we can have some control over our own creation, perhaps. So I want to end by going out on a little bit of a limb here and discussing some ways in which we might resolve some of these issues. I'm going to start with a quote from a professor of mine about 25 years ago. Said, discussions about evolution and creation are moot because time is an illusion. In other words, if you want to resolve the issue of how long did it take for creation to occur, well, if you're willing to play with the notion of time, then in fact it becomes a non-issue. And this is, I think there was some depth to this statement, not just a good way to get a room full of graduate students to chuckle during their class. So here are some examples. Relativity theory questions the fundamental notions of simultaneity. cosmology tells us that time began in a very literal sense with the Big Bang. That is, the Big Bang did not happen at some point in time. That's when time started. New results from neuroscience, which I would be happy to tell you about, are very interesting, tell us that even very simple aspects of time perception can be inaccurate. There are cases in which I can flash two very small points of light, say a red one and a green one. If I do them with the correct timing in relationship to an eye movement that you're making, you will see them occur in a reverse order, not in the order in which they actually occurred. Now, this is a very low-level fundamental process, and yet it's screwing up our perception of time. So if these things are going on, we may need to rethink our understanding of and relationship to time, and in the extreme, let's say if time is an illusion, then maybe there is no distinction, in fact, between created and being created, so that when we say God created the universe, created us, that's perfectly compatible with the fact that we are still being created if we're willing to take a little bit more liberal approach to our interpretation of time. Thank you.
Okay. We have quite a bit of time for questions.
Is this ability to learn from people who have been blind, is this like a vocabulary that is set by the early teens, say?
I don't know for sure. I don't know. Bill might be able to tell us a little bit more about that. But it's certainly better. You're certainly better off doing it early. So it gets harder to change. But I think, actually, there is some... I do know one data point on that, and that is related to the strabismus work, the eye misalignment work. And it was thought for a long time that if you had not started the patching process and the realignment process by, I think, age 12 or something like that, it was pretty much written off. You were too late. But in fact, studies are now finding that it's still possible to do that. So that's a different thing. Now I'm talking about a muscle alignment, almost a mechanical problem, but it is possible to get the brain to do that correction even after age 12. So don't know definitely, but I think it's going to get harder as you get older, but it's still possible.
On that question, there's experimental work where you close one eye. Sorry, to do it deliberately. You provide a cataract, and then you remove the cataract at different ages, and that enables you to determine what is the sensitive period. And whereas in monkeys and cats, it's a few months. In human beings, the most sensitive period is about 3 years, but it does continue up to about 6 or 7 years. But it's certainly over before 13 years.
Okay.
5, 6, or 7.
For the visual processes?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
If the image remained intact, whatever happened in the Garden of Eden, what is your concept of the meaning of the image today?
I don't know how to address that question. Let me say this. I think it may be... There's no doubt that we are subject to visual illusions, right? We've all seen the books and seen optical illusions of various kinds, and they're a lot of fun. But there are illusions in all the sensory systems. So I'm not sure if it's exactly addressing your question, but I would say, in some sense, if our understanding and perception of time is inaccurate, there is a whole list of ways which I could tell you that our sensory experience of the world is also inaccurate. So it does makes you call into question how much of any of this that we're experiencing is really the way it actually is. So I don't know if it addresses your question, but that's the question I could answer.
This thing of cooperating with God and His creation, you ask, are we partners in God's creation? And then I ask myself, when attachment of a child is critical up to, say, age 6 months or up to 5 years, if we do not help a child, my child, to get attached, I am not cooperating with God in in his creation of a healthy human being, one who is loved, one who has boundaries set, one who learns to perceive God. And Dawkins wants us to stop teaching children religion. I believe if we do that, then we're not cooperating with God in his creation to form Christ in us. We cannot form it unless you cooperate with God right from an early age.
Well, I would agree. Yeah.
Randy.
Mark, I just wondered how you would differentiate between the term being created that you used and the term development. Are they synonymous in every way, interchangeable, or are they synonymous
even
not spiritually, or what are you trying to convey with that?
Well, there's a point at which it just becomes a semantic difference if you're not careful, and I'm not clear where that is, because some of this, you could question even the neuroscience results that I've discussed, because these kinds of changes still require the development processes to be intact. So you could say that there are problems with there are ways to alter what's going on in the brain, but the processes that do the alteration, the adaptation, the habituation, must be intact for those to occur, even in a pathological manner. So I can't give a definitive answer.
One more time,
yes.
Are you implying, that I don't want to misunderstand it here, that somehow development refers to the kind of physical development of a capability, and that being created has more to do with our ability to perceive or to interpret, or is that way off base?
The second part is correct, at least. Now, I'm not sure about the first part. I'm not sure how much of a distinction you can make between creation and development, because your process of being created in some sense is not done until you've developed some processes.
Sam,
two comments, not questions really. One is that my daughter taught Richard Dawkins' daughter in high school, aged about 9. And all these little girls send Christmas cards to their teacher. And my daughter had a Christmas card from young Miss Dawkins. "Dear Miss Berry, thank you very much for making science interesting to me at last." Second comment, which actually follows on directly from what we were talking about a moment ago. The more I look at the Bible, the more I find it concerned with processes rather than static existences. We read Genesis 1 as if it was intact in itself, but it is a snapshot of God saying, "Great, I've done a good job. You know, where do we go next? We go from a garden to a city. We go from sin to salvation. The whole thing's a process. Don't let's get hung up on statics."
Right.
Which is, I think, what you were saying.
Absolutely. If we had this discussion yesterday, you would have been a co-author by now on this.
Oh, thank you.
We have time for one more, and I think that's David.
I was wondering if your research has any explanation of the miracle of Jesus healing the blind man in 2 stages. He said, "I see men as trees walking."
Oh, thank you.
Does the role of experience of the brain give insights into what was happening there?
I wish we didn't have to end with that question. I don't know.
Mark, I think there is an interesting thing to say about that. I think that knowing about visual development, as Mark has outlined it here, makes you realize that the miracle of healing the man who was blind from birth is a much bigger miracle than any of us ever realized before this neuroscience came along. Because it's not a matter simply of correcting the primary defect, the cause of blindness, which might be cataracts or might be something simple out in that orbit, but for that person to actually see and interpret the image that's coming in, there had to be millions of synapses changed in the brain.
Right.
So that...
They're seeing, and then they're seeing.
When I read that story from the Gospel of John as a neuroscientist, I read it with a lot more awe, I think, than non-neuroscientists because of what I know about visual brain.
Right. It's like the difference between hearing and listening. I mean, I can hear what you're saying, but that doesn't mean I'm paying attention to it and it's making any sense. Good. Now, you're a co-author now as well.
Thank you very much.